when, yeah, Banji's really looking at this notion of experience. It's interesting because he says it's a modern notion. There's no word for that in traditional Buddhism. You won't find that. You won't find that word experience in or any version of it in Buddhist texts. We kind of, it's funny that, isn't it? Because it's so much a word we use, but it wouldn't exist. And as I was saying before, the sort of good thing about thinking in terms of experience is we know that, we know we're not talking about abstract thought. We're talking about something we live through. But there's also downsides to this as well. And I think the main thing Banti is sort of challenging, and it really is a challenge to any of us trying to live any sort of Dharma life or any sort of spiritual word, any sort of spiritual life, sorry, is the sort of connotations of acquisitiveness that come with this notion of talking about enlightenment as experience. Because then we immediately think, well, I want to have it. I want to have that experience of enlightenment. But of course, enlightenment isn't something that we can have, yeah? It's not something that, you know, an ordinary experience is something we live through and sort of go through and come out the other end, as it were. But enlightenment, we don't come out the other end because there is no end. Yeah, there is no end. It's something that we continue living in, if that's the right way to put it. So yes, it's these connotations of acquisitiveness. And Maitreya Bandhu last week was talking about how we can often yearn for experience to sort of compensate for the dullness of our lives. It's a sort of classic thing, isn't it? We sort of dull our minds by, well, all the things we do, you know, looking at a screen all day, and then we try and fire up our minds by, I don't know, like, doing something very exciting or watching something very exciting or even frightening, you know, like a horror movie or something is a classic thing, you know, so our lives are dull, even we dull our lives, and then we long for experience. And Maitreya Bandhu talked last week, and I remembered it because I resonated with it, about if you've had a day like that, where you felt a bit sort of alienated and cut off, you don't quite want to go to sleep, you don't quite want to go to bed, you kind of think, oh, I haven't had it yet, you know, and I noticed that, you know, I sort of stay up too late, you know, trying to sort of have something satisfying, you know, whereas actually on retreat, I don't have that. On retreat, I find it easy just to go to, it feels like a healthy sleep at the end of a sort of fulfilling day, usually. Do people sort of relate to that? Yeah. So it's a sort of passive approach to life, because it's an approach to life where we're expecting something from life. And Banti in the lecture, I think this is quite useful, he distinguishes between attainment and acquisition. He talks about attainment as something natural, as a matter of growing. Actually, I'll come on in a minute to growing in more detail, but something natural. And acquisition is more a matter of appropriation. Again, there's that passivity. We're trying to add something onto ourselves. Attainment, growing, is where something sort of naturally flourishes. Acquisition is when we're adding something onto ourselves. And I was thinking, even on the sort of ordinary psychological level, I think we know the difference in feeling when we've attained something than to when we've acquired something. Even when that acquiring is quite innocent, not that acquiring is bad in itself even. And I had a nice little example of this. I was home visiting my mum a couple of weeks ago in Scotland. And she had some little video clips of my nephew who lives in France. It's, you know, obviously the trend these days, wasn't when I was younger, is to video every single moment almost of a child's growing up. But anyway, these were some video clips of my nephew who's 10. And there was two different little clips. They're both lovely, actually. So when one, it was his birthday, it was his 10th birthday, and he was being given as a birthday present, as a special surprise, a trip to Legoland. Yeah, so that was his special surprise. Except he said it in a French accent, something like Legoland or something. But anyway, so he was given a car by his parents, and all this has been videoed, of course. And it said, you know, happy birthday, Roman, that's his name. And there was this little voucher in it that they had, I think, made the trip to Legoland. And it was quite sweet because at first he didn't see the voucher. He just saw the card. He seemed quite happy with the card on his own. And then his little sister pointed out the voucher and he was delighted. You know, he was happy. And there was a few moments of excitement and he was happy. So that was fine. And then the other clip was, he's learning to play the trumpet, also my nephew, and he'd had a little music exam, and he was going into his school to see the results. They were pinned up on the wall, and again, this was being videoed. And anyway, he'd got a distinction in trumpet, and he went up, and he looked at this, and he saw that he'd got a distinction, and he literally was jumping for joy. I mean, he was beside himself with happiness. He was jumping for joy, and he couldn't believe it, you know, his delight. And I just thought, it was striking to me, the contrast. So the trip to Legoland had made him happy. He wasn't unhappy. But I would say he was about 100 times happier with the, you know, his sort of achievement, really, of the thing. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. The thing that's been given, I mean, perfectly innocent. There's nothing wrong with being given a trip to Legoland if that's what you're into. You know, it's not in any way unskillful, but, you know, when something's been given to you, that's one thing. But, you know, when you've, by your own effort, sort of realised something and realised your sort of potential, it's a greater joy, and it's a greater joy. And it's very, very clear in his uninhibited childlike way that he was showing this greater joy. So I thought, yeah, even on the psychological level, even on this ordinary level, when we just grow, when we naturally grow into something, it's more satisfying than when we're simply kind of handed something kind of on a plate, as it were. So Banti's making this distinction between attainment and acquisition. And he says that we've always got this mixed up in our minds. Yeah, we've always got this mixed up. He says that in principle, we'll all believe in attainment. We'll all want that from our Dharma lives. We always want to think in ways that are in accordance with attainment, this natural flourishing, but we'll behave in terms of acquisition. Yeah. So we, in other words, we'll always have mixed motives, and sometimes you catch yourself out in this. And I thought I'd just tell you, embarrassing as it is, when I recently caught myself out in this. Well, it's an embarrassing moment, but the Dharma life, I think, is built on humiliation, if we can learn from it. If we can learn from it. So you catch yourself, but you sort of know, but Bhante's other, you know, elsewhere said, very, very good aphorism of Bhante's, we have to find emotional equivalents of our intellectual understanding. So, you know, we all sign up for, the sort of attainment version, but we're all acquisitive. I mean, unenlightened, actually, we will be acquisitive. We shouldn't give ourselves a sense of hard time for the mixed motives. It is interesting to catch ourselves out. So anyway, my example, actually, it was this same trip to Scotland. It was on my way there. I'd been at Adishtana in Birmingham, so I was travelling from Birmingham to Scotland, outside Birmingham. So I'd got to Birmingham from Adishtana, which is in Herefordshire. So as you know, anybody who's been there, Birmingham New Street, huge, big station, quite complex station in a way. Anyway, I'd got off the first train, and I happened to go off at the same time as quite an elderly lady, and she was elderly, and also she was clearly, you know, didn't know where she was. She was clearly completely not, you know, completely understanding a way bamboozled by this station. And so I could see her looking bamboozled, and I went to help her. I said, oh, you know. And she said, oh, you know, I need a platform such and such. Whatever. So I said, oh, you know, that's all right. You just need to go up these escalators. I'll be fine. And then at the same time, and I also noticed she had, she was carrying a rucksack, quite unusually actually for an elder lady. She had a huge, very heavy rucksack, and she couldn't, you know, it's quite hard to get your rucksack on your back. So I said, oh, I'll give you a hand up with this. So I helped her with her on her back. I think she was from Australia or New Zealand. So I helped her up with her rucksack, and so that was good. And then she said, oh yeah, I don't know where my next train is. And she said, it's all right, I've got lots of time. And she took out her ticket. And as she took it out, I saw that her onward journey was the same as mine. She was going to Carlisle and I was going off to Glasgow. And at that point, I must confess to you, my generosity sort of stopped, because I thought, we've got kind of about an hour to the next train. I don't really want to hang out with us. I've got kind of things to do, places to go. I've got my little plan. I'm going to go to prep, get my sandwich. I'm going to go to here. I'd all worked out how I was going to spend this 45 minutes. And I somehow thought, if I admit that we're on the same train, that I don't know what it would, in my imagination what it meant, but maybe she had plans as well, you know. But in my imagination, I thought, I have to look after her for the 45 minutes. So I didn't let on that we were on the same train. But then what happened was the train got cancelled. And I felt like such a wretch, you know. I felt, that's me caught. And because, I mean, I'm never going to find her again in New Street station. And so I had, you know, we all had to get the next train. And, you know, I looked for her at Carlisle and I never saw her. So basically, I don't know what happened to her. I feel like saying, if you're watching this, I'm sorry. but I felt like I was caught in exactly this, because not only was I caught in the lack of generosity, but it also made me see, oh God, I don't know why I started this, it's so embarrassing to admit, but how the sort of self-aggrandizement, you know, when I was helping her with the ticket and the bag, it was almost like I felt like I had a sort of a little imaginary audience. It was like, oh, look at me, you know, I help old ladies, you know, I'm helping her with her bag, you know, look, I'm not just helping her with this van, I'm helping, you know. So I was caught in acquisitiveness, you know, I was caught in the acquisitiveness of this being a good Buddhist. I thought, oh, look at me, look at Subhadramati, the great kind of, you know. So that's what I mean by being caught. So I was caught in doing exactly what Van said. I had mixed motives. There was a generous impulse. You know, I'm glad I helped her rather than didn't help her. But there was a definite, well, two things. There was the definite, you know, that's where it wasn't free-flowing, but also there was the, you know, the kind of, you know, the pride, really. The sort of, and the you know, you can have positive pride, but that wasn't positive pride. So yes, mixed motives abound. I like what Banti says. He says that we have this mixed motive, we have this sort of acquisitiveness because we're alienated from life, so we're looking for compensation. I like that because I think in a way he's not saying we're bad, you know, he's just saying, oh, we're just alienated. You know, if you were completely in tune with life, you wouldn't need this compensation of, oh, look how good I, you know, you wouldn't need that little buzz of, look how good I am. You'd just be in the flow. You'd have, I mean, who knows what I would have just, what meant to, it might have, maybe I'd still have acted in the same way, but it wouldn't have had that sting. And I'd have just known, if you're in the flow, you're more relaxed, so you know what to do at the time. Actually, there's many skillful ways I could have still helped her and had my bread sandwich, you know. But because I was a little bit tense, because I was like, oh no, you know, I wasn't in the flow. So when we're alienated, we won't be in the flow of life, and then we'll be left sort of wanting and we'll look for compensation, yeah. So Banti, and again, we touched on this last week, he goes on to say, if we expect to be given an experience, will expect that to come from somewhere, someone, or something. Yeah, we'll expect that experience to come from somewhere. And he says that often that where will be somewhere exotic. Especially if you're practicing a religious life, you look for, you know, we as Buddhists, we want the exoticism of, you know, the where we think Buddhism, you know, the East, you know, if we're just there, probably thinking the same, and the other way around. So Bhante calls that pseudo-spiritual exoticism. Or you expect it from someone, yeah, that sort of projection. I was thinking a way to know if you're... a sure way to know that you've been projecting onto someone, spiritual or otherwise, is if you ever suffer betrayal. If you ever suffer a feeling of betrayal, this is quite a challenging thing I'm saying here, but it's true actually, I firmly believe this, it means that you projected onto that person, yeah? And you've expected something from them, and then you feel betrayed because they aren't giving it to you. Actually, from their point of view, they're just living their life, you know. If you feel betrayed, that is a sure sign that you've projected on to them. Of course, I'm not saying that it's not a difficult experience, betrayal, but that's how we can look at it. Actually, we could have a whole evening on that one night, perhaps. It's a big subject, but I'm gonna press on. Because this, in a way, is by way of recap. Or we'll look for that experience from something. And Bhante calls that pseudo-spiritual technism. In other words, you latch onto one technique or practice, and you think this is it, and at the expense of everything else, then you try and sort of sell it, as it were, to everyone else. Yeah, you become a sort of evangelical about this particular technique. Yeah. So this is the basic danger, Bhante is saying, of thinking of enlightenment in terms of experience, yeah, that we fall into acquisition, we then want that experience, and that's an acquisitive approach. Actually, he spends most of the time, the lecture is about, on my Kindle, it's about 16 pages long, and I think he spends maybe the first 13 pages talking about the dangers, and then he just spends the last three talking about what's the way out. So in a way, we're going to have to expand on that. So he gives three ways, three alternative approaches, yeah? And so last week, we looked at, instead of talking in terms of progress, we talked about talking in terms of growth, yeah? Talked about in terms of growth. So I thought I'd just pause there because some people were here last week, and this is still by way of a recap. So can anybody remember from last week what are the advantages in talking in terms of growth? What's the classic Buddhist image in terms of growth? I'm sure you know that.
The lotus.
The lotus. Very good, Brian. Film marks. The lotus. Yeah. All those years have paid off, yeah. So the lotus, and of course when the Buddha, upon enlightenment, the Buddha had a vision of all beings as being like lotuses. So what are the advantages of thinking in terms of growth? How does that help us out of this kind of the pitfalls of acquisitiveness?
There's a growth up and a growth down.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And anywhere else?
The growth? All around.
And all around, yeah, 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 yeah. And what's why is that good in a way? Why is
that? Well, like, it doesn't
Yeah.
It doesn't exclude anything. It's also, it's directionless in the sense that it's radial, it grows out from a central point rather than towards a specific.
Yeah.
I think that's quite
good. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, very good. Well remembered. Because it's a bit, classically we can either talk about spiritual life in terms of a path, you know, where we're here and we're going somewhere, or we can talk about it as growth. So you've either got this this journey through space where we're going from A to B, or this journey through time. We're opening in this radio way all at once. We're going out, up to the highs, down to the depths. The lotus, of course, grows from the mud, so that's the metaphor. We're bringing everything with us. And the advantage of the lotus growth model is that, yes, it's all of us. It's we who grow. We grow and we transform in that growth. The lotus grows from a bud to this amazing, miraculous, really flower that you couldn't even imagine when you just see the little shoot poking up. You couldn't imagine this huge lotus flower. I'm not so familiar with lotuses, but you know, something like a rose. You know, when you just see the little shoot, you can't imagine this. The redness, the scent, the velvetiness, all the colours. It seems unimaginable when you just see the little, spiky bud, you know, tight little green thing. So that's the advantage. The advantage is it's all of us. Whereas if you think in terms of a journey, you can somehow think it's the same. It'll be the same me at the end of the journey as the beginning. You know, it hasn't got that aspect of transformation, the miraculousness so clearly. Yeah. Is there anything else that's the model of growth? This image of the lotus has got going for it, as it were. If you can remember from last week, or just your own thinking, even if you weren't here last week. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I guess the journey can seem like a long schlep.
Yeah.
With the lotus image, you know, if you have a good meditation, then it's like full lotus.
So that's interesting, isn't it? And yeah, the journey can feel like a long schlep. Interesting. Again, the downside of the journey is it can feel discouraging if you feel like, oh God, the goal's miles off, as it were. You can either feel very discouraged, or you can feel the opposite. You can almost feel, oh, look at me, like I'm nearly at the goal. Wow, like, haven't I brilliant? And it sounds like the lotus model is something that you can reconnect with more easily at any point. Yeah, you can always reconnect with it. Well, it's very, maybe it's one of those things that's so obvious that it's easy to miss. So if you think about a lotus or a rose or anything growing, how does that happen in a way? I'm trying to sort of lead you to the answer, maybe I'll just say it.
It's a natural process.
It's a natural process, yes, yes, a natural process, yeah. That's what I was trying to kind of give you. So it's a natural process, So they're all the pluses. Interestingly enough, what's the sort of, in a way, the negative side, or the not so good? Every metaphor's got a kind of good aspect and a not so helpful aspect. What's the not so helpful aspect of the growth model, the model of Dharma life as growth?
You need nourishment to grow.
So
if you don't have the opportunity for nourishment, then
you might not develop. Well, that's true in fact. Yeah, that's true in fact. And actually, we can see that our work is to give nourishment. So that's true in fact. But what about the actual model itself?
I guess it could encourage you to be more passive.
So how would that work, Rohan?
Well, kind of, I guess, sort of noticing where your sort of hindrances are.
Well, how would it work the other way? How would it encourage you to be more passive?
Oh, the kind of lotus one.
Yeah.
The kind of idea that if you just, things will come naturally.
So interesting, the naturalness has got both a positive, you know, in that we're not doing something that's alien to ourselves. It's the unfoldment of our own potential So the naturalness has got the positive side, but also potentially it could make us bad. We think, oh, well, all I have to do is just sit here and I'll just unfold like a lotus, yeah? So it could encourage passion. And then, yes, we'd have to work against that by the things you said, yeah? So I think that's always good to remember with any sort of any metaphor for the Dharma life. We're always, it's always got a good bit to it. And Maitreya Band always says it's got a front and a back. Yeah, it's always got something that'll help us. But also we don't want to, we don't want to take a metaphor literally. That's why it's a metaphor, yeah?
So,
yeah.
Can I just say, the thing that popped into my mind was taking up space.
Yes.
And I kind of have a picture of a whole load of lotuses.
Yeah.
And, you know, the pond has to expand, basically.
Yeah,
you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Because at the, there's this, it's this thing of, like, jostling for space.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? And again, that's where metaphors... they outgrow themselves, if I can still use it. So I was thinking either the pond has to go bigger, or maybe actually you realise the lotuses are all made of light as well, so all the light enters it. So I think that's another thing with a metaphor. It always, again, can't be taken literally. Or you think, oh yeah, how are all these lotuses going to fit in the pond? But of course... there is no limit to how much a human being can grow. Again, that's where the metaphor breaks down, because actually a lotus has got a finite size, but we can grow beyond the bounds of lotus, and then, we will become lotuses of light to carry on with that. So in a way, there's two ways that we can't take a metaphor literally. At least two. So one, the metaphor will outgrow its own self, and also it'll have a limitation, and so we mustn't take it literally either way. So anyway, so that's all by way of sort of recap, but you can go over and over these things again, and I hope this, although it's a sort of recap, will feed into Bhante's next. He's got three things, one we're saving for next week, but he's got three ways of looking enlightenment as non-experience. They're all quite funny, because non-experience sounds so esoteric, and actually these three things Bhante gives us are very, very pragmatic. So he talks about growth, thinking in terms of growth, and then the next one is work. So that might be a surprise to you. Work, he says we can think in terms of work. So, that's an interesting one, isn't it? So we're going to have to look at what he means by work. So he's quite clear from the beginning. He says work, it certainly isn't work in the sense of sort of the wage slavery. It certainly isn't work just in the sense of something we've got to do, we don't like it, but we have to do it to get money. So it's not work in that sense. He says it's not even work in the sense of sort of more gainful employment, but he says, and I'll quote him, he says it's the productive expenditure of energy. Yeah, it's work in the sense of the productive expenditure of energy. Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? I wouldn't have guessed that he'd come on to, when he was talking about enlightenment as non-experience, he'd come up with something so almost so prosaic as work. So why do you think he said that? What's good about work in this sense? What's good about the productive expenditure of energy? Why do you think Bhante said that? Yes?
It's fulfilling.
It's fulfilling. Okay, can you say a little more?
That's what we were talking about in our little group that was all sort of came down to spending energy in a productive way, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a sense of fulfillment, yeah. So somehow our energy needs a channel, doesn't it? Yeah.
Is there a sense of, because if it's enlightenment as non-experience, if it's work in the way you're describing it, if you get into a state of flow, that you're somehow losing a sense of self in work.
Yeah.
So if it's real in the way you're describing work,
I think that's right. I think that's very good, actually. Yeah, you're you're no longer thinking, at its best, you're no longer thinking, oh, this is me. It's not like me and the lady. I'm not thinking, oh, this is me. It's like, you just do it. You're just responding to what needs done. Because I think that's often the other thing about work. There's a something objective there. You're doing something. It's productive, you know. Yeah, I think that's very good, yeah. And again, that the feeling of that is very satisfying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I have to do what I want to do.
Yeah.
I have to do things I don't want to
do.
Most people probably don't.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sounding a bit vague.
I think we know what you mean, yeah.
When I do that, I feel as though it's a great achievement, so it ties up with what you say about achievement.
Mm-hmm. When you do the things that you don't want to do.
Yeah, in order to enable the things I want to do work-wise. And, you know, it's things like I try to remember to congratulate myself.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, or you got through that, or you did that, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. I think what's interesting about what you say, Alison, is that you're doing something. It's quite conscious what you're doing. I think it's interesting. Sometimes in work, we may not necessarily enjoy the specific task, but if we know why we're doing it, if we're doing it because it accords with our value, it completely changes the task, doesn't it? I was just thinking about on the class here where we've got a whole team of many of you who are here, and actually being on the team means doing quite ordinary things, the hoovering, the washing up. But well, for myself, I don't know about you, but it feels different hoovering here, say, you know, than doing my own hoovering, because you know we're hoovering because we're keeping the centre going. So the task itself. Can be in this bigger perspective, and I think that's similar to what you're saying. You're doing this thing, but it's in the context of something that you really want to do. I wanted to show you this. I told you it was just a Majumaloka, not Majumaloka, sorry, Adistana, just now at the weekend, and again actually the weekend. We had a big order weekend, 300 of us. I just got back a few hours ago. And anyway, they're having a big clear out of all the archives. So they were giving away all their old pamphlets just in a box for people to take. And who could resist this? Look, I just thought, what a kind of great sort of retro design of newsletter. So this is called Friends of the Western Buddhist Order Newsletter 28. The Friends of the Western Buddhist Order is what Tri Ratna used to be called. And I just picked up because of the kind of groovy retro colour. And then I looked outside and I thought, this is interesting because as Sila Pia mentioned, and we've been mentioning each week, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of building this centre this year. And there's a whole big article in here written when they're actually building it. So this must have been pre-1978, this magazine. And there's a whole thing about, they're talking about, everything, pulling all the timber out and how they discovered the dry rot. There's another article in our magazine about this. There's some old photographs of me, and I don't know if you can see them, but they're so grainy and old, you can hardly make anything out. But I thought, I'll pick this up and this might be interesting. That was my first interest was the cover. The second interest, it's about building the London Buddhist Centre all those years ago. You know, interest actually. They were building like mad, every day. They still did 2 hours meditation day. Also, there's a really, really funny thing because there's a little advert for their retreats at the end. And one of them says, 3-week working retreat at the new London Buddhist Centre, no charge. And I thought that was rather funny. When you hear the stories of what it was like building this place, you think, you're right, no charge. We're sort of living on bare floorboards, Anyway, but then I was on the train coming home and I couldn't help flicking through a little bit more. And I started just looking at the editorial and I thought, it really ties in with this theme for tonight. because you know 40 years ago our whole everything was a much much smaller operation, and the guy who's the editor, he's saying, oh, up to this point what we've had is there's just been a benevolent, he said, order member or two who are trying to teach and open everyone up to a rich new world of ideas. He said, but now, you know, we're trying to build this centre, so we've got to do work, we've got to talk about money, we've got to take responsibility. He says, to some of you, you know, this might sound like all the fun's coming to an end. He says, to some of you, this might find quite unspiritual. You know, up till now, we've just been like going on retreat when we felt like it, you know, having inspiring talks. Now it's like a bit like roll your sleeves up and like build a centre. But he says, it all may seem rather unspiritual, but he says, should anyone at this point feel this is where he or she wants to get off, they'll miss out on an extraordinary opportunity. So I thought, oh, that's interesting. So what? I thought I might just ask us, because he doesn't actually spell out what it is, the extraordinary opportunities, but why do you think he says that? You know, so here they've all been kind of having a lovely spiritual time, and now it's time to build a centre, take responsibility, form committees. But he's saying, if you leave now, you're going to miss an extraordinary opportunity. What do you think he's getting at?
I think it's like you know, nothing worth having is easy.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
That kind of feeling of
yeah. Yeah, so that's interesting. So maybe it's a bit like my nephew with a trumpet, isn't it? When we put our backbone into something. So what are we, just to sort of unpack that a bit more, what are we doing when we put our backbone into something?
Just giving it your all, giving it your full attention, giving it your,
yeah.
your heart, you know, your heart's in it, your heart, your head, your
yeah.
body, everything's in it.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
It's got that full attention.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's it. I think that's the answer. I think by working, we're putting our whole selves in it, literally our backbone. And what Nagabodhi, the editor, he said, the time must come when we have to act in accordance with our values, which is just what you've described. It's like one thing to kind of go, oh, lovely, lovely, you know, got these values, whatever they are. I mean, here, you know, for me, they're Buddhist values, but all of us might have different values. You know, we can give them lip service, but when we act, it's we're putting our whole selves into it. Yeah, so I think that's it. So is there anything else to add on that? I'm going to go on a little bit, but
transformation
so.
Happens in everyday life. Doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
What you're saying,
yeah.
For me, it's the difficulties of challenge.
Yeah.
Which is when I know I'm stuck. Actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where. Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's the same point. You know, you're faced with your real feelings, your real emotions,
yeah,
your
yeah.
real difficulties
yeah.
in everyday situations. That's,
yeah,
it's so much more interesting than being on retreat.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting, isn't it? So it sort of tests being on retreat, would you say? Yeah, 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 yeah. Because we're faced with other people, situation. Well, we've got other people on retreat, but you're faced with kind of real world, real life. Real, then you have to come up with real dharma. So it's a testing of your dharma practice. Yeah, yeah.
I think that as well. If you open your doors to a new centre.
Yeah.
If you've been quite a small group.
Yeah.
Room,
yeah.
Roughly the same values,
yeah.
the same words, use the
yeah.
same. Yeah. It's a real test if anyone can come in.
Yeah.
Does the dharma really work?
Uh-huh.
Can we hold it together?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, will there be infiltration?
Yeah.
So it was very brave.
Yeah.
You know, that was the moment for the organisation to
yeah.
test,
yeah.
does it work?
Right? Yeah, yeah,
can
yeah.
we
Yeah, 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 and maybe we do that every time. So this was a particular example, of a very good example, isn't it, building a centre? But yeah, I think that it tests everything, doesn't test us as individuals and tests us as a community. So, yeah, so I think So this is very good, isn't it? That when we're working, as we're acting in accordance with our values. Well, first of all, we have to know what our values are. And I think if actually if we know what our values are, we will act in accordance with them. If we, in a way you could argue, if you don't act, you don't know what your values are, or you don't know that your values are values. Do you see what I mean? If you have values, it will be almost the next step will be to work to keep creating those values, to keep sharing those values, to keep making sure those values come alive in the world. If you don't act in support of those values, can you really say that they're your values? Have you really understood that they are your values? So acting is a sort of, it's kind of putting your money where your mouth is, isn't it? Putting your action where your mouth is. It's showing that they're values. And of course that will strengthen and deepen the values. And then I think I just want to come back to what was touched on by Nico as well, that when we're working, that in itself, if we're really kind of in the flow, as you put it, that can be an experience where we, at least temporarily, aren't so much in the grip of self-clinging. We're more just responding, yeah? And what this really reminds me of is another incident in Bhante Sangharakshita's life, very, very important incident, long before he ever set up Tri Ratna. He was practicing as a monk in India. Bhante, if you don't know, he's an Englishman, but at a very young age, at 16 actually, went to India. He was drafted there by the army, and then at the end of the war he stayed there, ordained as a monk. He was practicing a lot of meditation and living the life of a monk at that time, very kind of, you know, strictly following the monastic code. But he realised that he was, all the practice he was doing still wasn't getting him any nearer to solving this problem of acquisitiveness. I mean, it would be subtle, you know, in the case of Bhante at that time, but it's still this tendency to of acquisitiveness in its subtle form was still present. Because, you know, the ego clinging is very sneaky, really. So it'll acquire even our efforts to, even our dharmic efforts. Yeah? It'll use them to shore up the sense of self. And it seems nearly impossible to break out of that, because you're trying to break out of a sort of self-generating thing. Every time you try and break out, you think, oh good, look, I broke out there. Do you see, you're immediately back in, because ego clinging will always keep acquiring it, yeah? And so he was very perplexed by this problem, which is quite right. Any spiritual practitioner should be perplexed by this. If you're not perplexed by it, you can say you're not really practicing. And he was reading Thomas Merton, who you may know as a great kind of Christian practitioner, monk, a Christian monk. And Thomas Merton had talked about this very same thing. How do you get out of this sort of, how do you get out of this self-clinging with the self, as it were? How do you do it? And after reading Thomas Merton, what Bhante decided to do is he quite consciously decided to completely hand over, as it were, his will, his Bhante's will, to his own teacher, who was called Jagdish Kashyap. It was a conscious decision to do that, and that's important. It wasn't an unthinking kind of a sort of sub-individual thing to do. Sometimes we do that, don't we? We just kind of passively let someone else tell us what to do. It wasn't that. It was a conscious, I'll deliberately decide to do what my teacher asks me. And there was a bit of a problem, because the teacher was a very kind of easygoing sort of person that never asked Bhante to do anything for ages, you know, and just kept saying, oh yeah, we'll do what you want. But eventually, the teacher did, Jagdish Kashyap did ask Bhante to do something. What happened is they both travelled up to Kalimpong, and Jagdish Kashyap decided to himself go on a long retreat, and he said to Bhante, stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. And Bhante was probably delighted that he had been asked to do something, but also probably slightly daunted, because he thought, what do you mean work for the good of Buddhism? Like, what am I supposed to do? You know, who's going to help me? You know, will people be friendly to me? Not friendly in the ordinary sense, but will people help in this work? Didn't look like they would at first. But of course, he had made this pledge, vow even, to do that, so he did do it. So I'm telling you this because this, because our deepest dharma work has to somehow be work towards this sort of deep self-forgetting, not forgetting in the sense of unmindfulness, but forgetting in the sense of not always circling everything back to me. Yeah. So I've remembered this and reflected on this incident quite a lot, and I've always reflected on it in terms of the act. You know, oh, there was Bhante working against ego clinging by doing not his own will, by the will of his teacher. But then I suddenly started to think about, because I was thinking about this, I thought of what he was actually asked. I hadn't really considered that before, that he was asked to stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, isn't it? He wasn't, Jagdish Kashyap didn't say to Bhante, oh, stay here and you go on retreat and meditate and so on. He says, stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. And I thought that must have been significant, that he gave Bhante a task to do, and Bhante did do that, and he did lots of work. That's a whole other story. He talks about it in his memoirs. And I think, again, it kind of circles back to what Nico said, and circles back possibly to what I was telling you about this 3-month retreat that I was on. But I think what work does for us is it gives us something objective. It gives us something outside of ourselves. And if it's work that's aligned with our own values, there'll be a very high... this is my experience, there'll be a very high degree of wanting to fulfill that work, yeah? So when I was leading the 3-month retreat, I mean, my inner voice to myself was, God, blimey, Subhadramati, how are you going to do this? Even you can't do this. Who do you think you are to lead a 3-month retreat? You've only ever led a 2-week retreat before. This is quite a step up, you know? So inwardly, I was thinking, golly, you know, am I going to be able for this? And even I could feel the part of myself that said, gosh, you know, can someone else do it? You know, someone more mature, more experienced and so on. But actually, yeah, we're on a Spanish mountain, there wasn't anyone else, so I had to do it. And what I started to notice was the retreat itself, if you see what I mean, was calling me to be bigger than I was, yeah? The retreat was calling me to be bigger. I really, really wanted this retreat to be the most positive experience as possible for the people on the retreat. It was an ordination retreat. 21 women were going to receive their ordinations. It's something I believe in more than anything else, this happening. So I couldn't go with the sort of voice that was going, oh, like, I can't do it, and like, do I have to, and like, couldn't someone else, and... you know, there was no one else. The retreat, I mean, I don't mean to say the retreat was difficult in itself. The women were all lovely. I just mean it was, you know, it was a stretch, you know. So the retreat itself called that from me. And that was so growthful. It was so growthful. I can't tell you, I've been back just a few months and I'm still feeling the growth. You know, to go back to that metaphor of unfolding, because I had to be bigger than I was. The situation demanded that. And I think that's what work does for us. If it is work in accordance with our values, it will call that forth. We want to fulfil it. So we'll sort of prove ourselves bigger than we thought we were. And to me, that's what I, in a sense, I think my whole Dharma life's been that. It's been looking for situations that don't leave me to my own devices. Left to my own devices, it's not so much that I'm lazy in the ordinary sense of the word, but it's probably a sort of variety of laziness. Actually, I've just realised this as I'm talking to you, that it is a variety of laziness that's kind of, can't I just hide with a crowd? You know, can't I just, do I really have to do this sort of stepping up and stepping on and stepping into being bigger? It's that variety of laziness left on my own devices. That's what I'm more likely to do. So my Dharma life has been sort of saying yes, really. Saying yes when someone asked me to lead something, to do something. Whether it was my first time here, somebody asked me to do something, and it was, would I help put the cushions away? I was so pleased, actually, that I'd been noticed, you know, as a regular, you know. And, I did say yes. So all the way to being helped to put the cushions away to lead a 3-month retreat. Actually, I shouldn't say this in public, should I? Now I'm realising I'm sort of digging my own grave, as it were, and somebody's going to ask me to lead a year's retreat or something like that, or do something. So I think that's what work gives us. It gives us something that's bigger than our own devices, that we can absorb ourselves in, and we can positively forget ourselves in. So I'll stop here, because I want us to end just with meditating for a few minutes. But I think, hopefully between us, we've seen why Bhante says the second way that we can work against even our Dharma lives becoming absorbed into this acquisitiveness that's part and parcel of being an unenlightened human being. The second great way is through work. Work for something we believe in. Work in a way that's aligned with our values, put our heart into it, our backbone into it, our whole selves into it, yeah? So let's just sit for a few minutes. We'll just sit quietly, but maybe you could think of maybe some act you could do this week that would be a sort of putting your money where your mouth is sort of act, something you could do to show yourself that you believe in your values, yeah? We'll just sit for 5 minutes.